politicians are opposed to a ceasefire. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. It's now day 25 of the Israeli war on Gaza, with the regime pounding the territory from air, land, and sea. At least 11 people have been killed in the latest Israeli strikes. The attacks have so far claimed the lives of over 8,500 people, including nearly 3,500 children. 21,000 Palestinians have also been injured. Officials in Gaza say that more than 1,000 people are still missing under rubble of the buildings destroyed. Israel has dropped more than 18,000 tons of explosives on Gaza since October 7th. Palestinians accuse the regime of using internationally banned white phosphorus bombs in attacks on the besieged territory. The military wing of Hamas's movement, the Al-Qassam Brigades, has released footage showing clashes between its fighters and Israeli soldiers have entered northern parts of the Gaza Strip. The brigade says that its forces are engaged in fierce clashes with the regime forces in different areas. The resistance movement says its fighters have fired rockets at the regime's military vehicles, destroying several of them. They've also targeted two Israeli settlements and a military outpost with mortars. Islamic Jihad also dismissed Israeli claims about making major advances in the ground invasion of Gaza. The movement says that Tel Aviv is deliberately misleading information about its attempts to penetrate into the besieged Palestinian territory. Now, as we've been reporting over the past weeks, Gaza is suffering from a dire humanitarian crisis under Israeli attacks. The situation, as described by the International Committee of Red Cross, is worsening by the hour amid Israel's complete blockade of the Strip. The handful of aid trucks allowed into Gaza through the Egyptian border are nowhere near enough, as attested by the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees.
The system in place to allow aid into Gaza is geared to fail unless there is political will to make the flow of supplies meaningful, matching the unprecedented humanitarian needs.
In his address to the UN Security Council, the Honorable Chief warned that basic services are crumbling while medicine, food, water, and fuel are running out. He said that nowhere is safe in Gaza from Israeli bombardments, not even the south, where the regime has been pushing the people to go to. The UN Commissioner said that even churches, mosques, hospitals, and UNRWA facilities sheltering displaced people have not been spared. In conclusion, Lazzarini called on the UN Security Council to demand an immediate humanitarian ceasefire, which he described as a matter of life and death for millions. The Israeli military has raised the house of the deputy political bureau chief of the Hamas resistance movement in a village near the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. The house was demolished during a raid on that village. Our correspondent Mona Kandil has the details.
We are speaking about the senior Hamas official, Saleh Al-Arouri. He's the deputy leader of Hamas and founding member of its armed wing here in the occupied West Bank, and he's based in Lebanon. This morning, the Israeli forces raided the village of Arura, the village of Arura near Ramallah, and surrounded the house of Saleh Al-Arouri. However, this house had been vacant for several years, and they bombed the house, destroyed it, and caused severe damage to the nearby buildings, the neighbors' buildings and homes as well. These two weeks ago, the Israelis had already raided Arura, and exchange of fire have erupted. The Israeli soldiers had arrested a number of Palestinians. But this morning, before the Israeli forces raided the village of Arura, they dropped leaflets in the village of Arura and the nearby villages, warning the residents of the village and the nearby villages. Speaking about the Israeli aggression as well, Also today, the Israeli forces have raided several areas in the occupied West Bank, not only Arura, and arrested, according to the Palestinian Prisoners Society Group, the Israeli troops have arrested at least 38 people from across the occupied West Bank.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has released a video of three Israeli captives demanding Benjamin Netanyahu agree to a prisoner swap. Now, the Palestinian movement has dismissed the recent announcement by the Israeli regime regarding the release of an Israeli soldier during raids in Gaza. Hamas official says that the claim aims to undermine the impact of the video that has shocked the Zionist community. Some 200 people were reportedly taken captive during Operation Al-Aqsa Flood on October 7th. They also include high-ranking military officials. Hamas has already released four captives on humanitarian grounds, and it says at least 13 captives have been killed in Israeli air raids on Gaza. The movement says it's ready to swap all the captives with 6,000 Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. The Russian president has blamed the U.S. and its allies for Israel's massacre of Palestinians in Gaza and many other deadly conflicts across the globe.
Behind the tragedy of the Palestinians and behind the massacre in the Middle East in general, behind the conflict in Ukraine, behind many other conflicts in the world, in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and so on, are the ruling elites of the United States and their satellites. This is already obvious to everyone.
Putin was delivering a televised statement to a meeting of the Security Council, government, and the heads of law enforcement agencies. The Russian president said that American politicians are opposed to a ceasefire in Gaza.
They don't want lasting peace. They want constant chaos in the Middle East. Therefore, they do their best to discredit those countries that insist on an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip, on stopping the bloodshed, and are ready to make a real contribution to resolving the crisis and not feeding like parasites on it.
Putin denounced indiscriminate killing of Palestinians in Gaza as unjustified. He also called for the creation of a sovereign and independent Palestinian state. Meantime, WikiLeaks has issued documents revealing Israel's plan for forced eviction of Palestinians amid more than 3 weeks of onslaught against the besieged Gaza Strip. The verified 10-page document from the Israeli Ministry of Intelligence was issued a week after the unprecedented Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. The advisory document outlines a four-stage forced expulsion and resettlement to Palestinians from Gaza to northern Sinai in Egypt. According to the document, Tel Aviv would initially instruct the Palestinians to evacuate north Gaza ahead of its land invasion. The plan envisions the Israeli military launching land operations from north to force the Palestinians to leave Gaza via the Rafah crossing. The outline also includes the establishment of 10 cities before constructions of permanent settlements for Palestinians in Egypt. An official from Israel's Ministry of Intelligence has verified a document issued in Hebrew. Now let me invite Saad al-Mutallawi, a former political advisor to the Iraqi government, to join me from Baghdad. Good to have you with us, Mr. al-Mutallawi. So we have had different reactions by different Muslim and non-Muslim countries. In some countries that openly support the Israeli regime, the people are out there and against the whims and wishes and the actions of their governments, and they're supporting the Palestinians. Let us know the situation in Iraq, where it seems that it's both the government and the people standing by the side of the Palestinians, and even they're taking some action by targeting U.S. bases.
Yes, thank you very much. Yes, definitely. Our position here in Iraq is obvious. The government, via the prime minister, declared the official position of Iraq in the peace summit in Egypt a few days ago, insisting on the complete right of the Palestinian rights in Palestine and their own state, and the stoppage of any further incursion by the Israelis, the Zionists in Palestine. So the government is very clear on this issue. Otherwise, the people and the other organizations, official and unofficial organizations, have all declared their readiness to take action and participate in any type of assistance required by the Palestinians. And the problem with what is happening today, and as I see, and some analysts have also, strategic analysts have been looking into this issue, and we found something quite dangerous for a number of neighboring countries, Arab countries, declaring their support to Israel in one way or another. Try to show themselves that they are on the side of the Palestinians, but their official actions coincide with the Israeli targets. So we are a little worried that there is a plan taking place now by displacing the Palestinian people furthermore, part to be distributed partly in Sinai and partly in Western Iraq and other parts of the region, by completely displacing the Palestinian nation, allowing Israel to expand from the Nile to the Euphrates as their ultimate target. And that means, that doesn't mean that the Israelis has to be, they have to occupy these countries. It's enough that some regimes working for Israel and that protecting the interests of Israel, and that means Israel have achieved their targets. So we are, these analysts have been talking of a necessity for Arab states and Islamic states to look further into the implementation of what is Israel trying to do and their ultimate plan by displacing Palestinians, not only in Sinai, but in generally. And the worrying issue is the silence of the international community and the green light that has been given to the Zionists to do whatever they like, regardless of all international rules and regulations and international treaties. That is quite worrying as we see it now, and we think there is something bigger is going on than just the skirmishes that are taking place in Gaza and the armed struggle between the Palestinians and the Israelis. There's something bigger going on, and we are worried. We are worried that something is happening.
Okay, now, before I ask my next question, Mr. Amatalabi, there is this breaking news I want just our viewers to know, that some 100 Palestinians have been massacred. There has been a bloody attack in the Jabalia refugee camp. And Jabalia refugee camp is located in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. And that's the live image that we see of Gaza. And unfortunately, we hear that some 100 people have been killed. And again, this number includes women and children. And the massacre is just going on. Mr. Mutalabi, let's talk about what Palestinian resistance fighters have been able to do in the past 25 days.
What the Palestinians have done is incredible. The way they managed to break the unbreakable borders and sneak into Israel, into the Palestinian occupied lands, and establish a presence, a military presence in that, in these areas, and for a number of hours, for 6 hours, and this presence continued until today. And the way they managed to strike at the heart of the Zionists, that has been incredible. The amount of heroism and the amount of bravery that these fighters have shown, and the accuracy of their missiles and their mortar attacks and the action taking on the ground is incredible. Very well trained. They have extremely well-trained and extremely brave and precise to the point. They achieved what the Arab armies could not achieve in three major wars. And these are a number of young kids with light machine guns and light armor. They managed to achieve something that none of the Arab armies have managed to achieve in 70 years. So one can only praise their actions and the incredible planning and the secrecy and the amount of preparation that has been done is absolutely incredible. And basically, they managed to cripple, to a certain extent, the Zionist army machine and cost the Israelis a large number of casualties in equipment and in souls. So, again, one can only raise the hat for the bravery and the technical ability to achieve what they have achieved. Without going into details, but they definitely were a sample of what armies should fight, should be like in fighting, and they should what they have done need to be taught to other military organizations.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Mutalibi.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The conversation. Hi, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we take you, the audience, back to October 12, 1984. In an event that shook the British establishment, a bomb detonated at the Grand Hotel in Brighton, England, killing five people and almost killing then-British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Our next guest was central to this IRA attack. As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildenew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's guest is Pat McGee. Pat is a former member of the IRA who was jailed for the Brighton bombing in 1984. After serving 15 years, he was released under the Good Friday Agreement. Pat McGee, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sean.
Pat, before we begin, can you tell me a bit about your childhood growing up in Belfast?
Well, at the age of four, I actually left Belfast. The family moved to England. But my best memories of those years were up to the age of four. You know, very solid memories. I'm talking about, I can detail events that happened when I know I was only two. And I think growing up in England, I felt very alienated there. It wasn't a very happy childhood, I have to say that. But I was always thinking about what I'd left behind in my grandfather's house. And I think because I used to go back to it all the time in my head, it firmed up those memories. And they're among the most firm memories I have. And it was happy time.
So, Pat, what age were you when you came back to Ireland? And, you know, what were those years like, and what motivated you to join the IRA?
Well, the family used to return to Belfast on occasions, and family members from Belfast used to visit us. We were living in a place called Norwich in England. And so I had those links, you know, and they remained quite strong. I first returned onto my own volition, when I was 19, but only for a short while. But it was specifically to see what was happening. I was concerned about what was happening as it was portrayed in the media. You just knew that you weren't getting the full story. This is before events even kicked off properly, as we understand it. But I came back instead at 20. And
what year was that?
That would have been 19, just after internment, so 71.
Okay.
August 71, 15th of August. It was that Sunday, or that Saturday night, yeah. And again, it was that desire just to see what was happening on the ground. Just before, the week before, that whole week taken up by events and over internment, you were getting a feed in the papers, and there were terrible events. And they were getting covered more than perhaps later on the press dealt with these issues. But you still knew that you weren't getting the full account. I had an aunt living in Andytown who had a phone, and I remember talking to her, and she was able to tell me that it was that bad that they had to hide behind the settee. You know, this is a gun battle in the streets in Andytown. And so, you know, they weren't covering that in the news. Mm-hmm. And so I came back just to see for myself. And I guess over a period of time, I got to see what was happening, got a better understanding of it. I would have been kind of, for example, I'd known guys, contemporaries who would have joined the British Army. And at that stage, I would have never have thought of them as Brits or had a bad view of them. But you're hearing all these accounts of what they were doing to people in the streets, you know, the abuse of people. And I couldn't square that with what I knew. Well, you see that for yourself. You're a witness to it. And I saw how people dealt with this occupation. You know, the constant raids. And our house was raided. The messing about in the streets, etc. Just general abuse. You felt that your home was occupied. Mm-hmm. And yet that community, it was a Carrickhill community. Them days, it was Unity Flats. You saw how they coped. And they're all doing it. Everybody seemed to me to be connected. And I just wanted to be a part of that. I wanted to be included in that. Didn't know what I could do, what my contribution could be. Really did not know. But I at least wanted to contribute in some way. Eventually that caused me to join the IRA.
When you joined the IRA, what year was that, Pat?
1972.
1972. So the year of Bloody Sunday was the beginning? January 72. And did the likes of Bloody Sunday, was that something that motivated you, or was it what you were seeing on the streets in Belfast?
More the latter. Just an accumulation. I mean, there was no big, you know, event. And that there were many big events, but no, it was an accumulation. What was happening, the daily grind, and seeing how people locally cope with that and wanting to be a part of it.
And of course, just moving on a bit, and we're going to start talking about the Brighton bomb in 1984. Can you tell me a bit about that, how you got involved in that?
Well, during internment, I was interned from 73 to 75. A lot of time to think. And how, again, it's just about what can I do? And I recognised that effectively the best we could do was to target England. Effectively, our actions, you know, with the little resources available to us, would count more there. And I thought, well, I've got a head start here. I was brought up in that. There's a lot of people around me, young lads, but I'm talking about jail, you know, internment. They've never been out of Belfast or never been out of there, you know, where they're from in the country. I had at least that. It seemed to me that put me at some sort of an advantage, you know. And so I came out of internment with a very firm view and commitment to somehow, you know, volunteer to be part of the English campaign. And I suppose the next period was achieving that end. And so eventually I was active in England. And it was seen as a campaign. Brighton, the Brighton operation, for all of its importance in terms of its targeting, was part of a campaign. We believed that the only way to get the Brits to the negotiating table was for a sustained campaign. Not one operation, no matter how significant, could achieve that. It was about getting a long-term, you know, attack in England. And I think eventually we did that after a lot of stops and starts, and I wasn't part of that. I was in jail by that stage. We'd have operated in England, withdrew because of logistics involved, and then come back to it. That wasn't a plan, the sort of pressure that was going to be needed. It took us a long time for the movement to gain what was needed. And eventually it did.
Pat, I suppose we know that the people who are operating in England or in Britain at all, there were sometimes greater risks, and certainly the way they were treated after arrest and all the rest was seemed to be pretty brutal. And I'm thinking of people like L. O'Dwyer and Martin Anderson, the Balcombe Street men. You know, there seemed to be a certain level of brutality against Irish prisoners in Britain, and innocent or not, they were all treated really badly, weren't they?
It's not quite as straightforward as that, because it was a long campaign, a long history of our people in jail in England. The real harsh days, or the early days, where it was brutal was the norm. Gradually, I think we got on top of it to the point where we were respected by screws and prisoners alike, and, you know, we established ourselves. But and you mentioned Ella and Martina. Their treatment was atrocious.
Absolutely.
As two women isolated. They've got a harsher, much harsher regime in terms of strip searches, etc., general messing about, than any male prisoner, never mind whether they're Republican or otherwise. It was brutal.
So just bringing it back to the Brighton bombing itself, can you tell me about your role in the Brighton bomb?
No, I can't really, but I don't want to. I don't want to talk about the specifics of the operation. It's just fair to say, like, that I was the person central, you know, he planted the device. But beyond that, I won't comment on it.
And will you tell us about your arrest then and what happened after the bomb?
Well, I was arrested in Glasgow on another operation about 9 months later. And I basically walked into a sort of a trap. Somebody else was being followed. I met them and became, it was in the net, so to speak. And we led them to the rest of the people we were working with. And that's how I was arrested, June 85.
You're still tuned in to The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. Michelle Gildery, my co-host, is here, alongside our special guest, human rights advocate Pat McGee. You just spoke about your time in prison, and you'd mentioned about Ella O'Dwyer and Martina Anderson, about the how they'd got it an awful lot worse than the male prisoners. Tell me, what was it like in jail in England? Because I know that you were then moved as part of the circumstances, you were moved to the north. Tell us just a bit more about your own treatment in jail.
Well, once you get through the year on remand and you're so taken up with the upcoming trial that all your thoughts are about that, so you don't really, you know, everything else bounces off you, you know, if you know what I mean by that. But then you're transferred, you know, the place you're going to be in for the rest of your life if they have their way. I was put in what's called a special secure unit. These were special units. They've been likened to prisons within prisons because of the security involved. But there would only be, say, seven prisoners, and it would be the same seven prisoners kept there for quite a number of years, very little coming or going. And there would be everything was isolated from the rest of the prison population, and the Screw contingent, they would be specific for the unit. So it's very claustrophobic, you feel isolated, and I think there's good cause to think that we all were damaged by it. I mean that, I felt it myself. There was at times when I verged on a breakdown. I was that close to it. I felt it, you know. But I ended up spending 4 years in two units, so 8 years in total in the units, before our transfer, was it, they call it transfer, we call it repatriation. A bit of a slip there. before my patriation, our patriation to back home. And our families have been campaigning for that for a long time. This has got to be borne in mind, even though we were there in prison, our whole families and our communities were affected by this. The terrible plight of your loved ones having to get the meagre means together to come across twice a year, say, to see you. We'd have accumulated our visits. We couldn't do it on a weekly basis. But so they pooled their visits and came over about twice a year, school holidays maybe, and at Christmas. So it was really tough on families, you know. I was transferred the day after the ceasefire declaration in 31st of August, 94. Very next day. In fact, we had won a concession in the jail. We were looking for sort of contact, a coverage, RTE coverage. And we got it. We got RTE coverage. And so we were able to see the declaration and, you know, the cavalcade with the flags out in Belfast. There, it was, we felt part of that, actually felt part of it. It was a jubilant moment. You know, a corner had been turned. And highly significant. And just after that, and I mean within minutes, a Screw came into the room and says, Pat and a couple of others says, get your bags packed. You know, you're going home. Can you imagine how stunning that was? Mm-hmm. And we all celebrated with a sing-song out our cell windows that night, and then the next morning we're huge security, transferred to Hull Airport, put on a specially commandeered plane, handcuffed, huge security presence on the plane, brought to Belfast International, the old Aldergrove, transferred a single prison van, all of us, and brought to the prison. You couldn't believe the difference, you know. That.
How many of you were in the van? And
three of us, and then a couple of Screws, probably three Screws. But it was all very low-key. I mean, as far as we were concerned, you know, we were going home. We're a step nearer home. In terms of the negotiations, we know what was going on. Things were moving ahead. But also that just we were amongst our own. Even though there were Screws, mm-hmm. you were hearing Irish accents for the first time, you know, yeah. When we were just submerged in all this Englishness. Mm-hmm. You know.
That must have been very special. And when, so the negotiations were going on, when did you sort of feel or hear the first moves of, you know, the settlement and the Good Friday Agreement and the work that was ongoing towards that and the moves towards...
So much here is what you know about what was happening in our present state at any given time. Standing in the dock, I knew we were good. Things are going in our direction. So, you know, the political development of Sinn Féin, etc., and the mounted campaign, things were more positive at that moment. And within a year of that, you know, the political developments, and that continued. So it was going to go there, but we still knew we had to kind of knuckle down and get through the sentence. Mm-hmm. I estimated that, this is just me, this is my peculiar way of looking at things, I thought there'd be a focus on a political solution before the new millennium. I thought that would concentrate their minds. We know it happened well before that. Mm-hmm. But that was my time scale of what I thought I had to cope with personally, yeah. You know, so you're geared to that.
So you were gearing up for the remainder of your sentence here. Mm-hmm. You were amongst your own people. Your family, it was easier for your family to visit. You didn't feel the same sense of isolation. But then you were released under the Good Friday Agreement. So how did that feel? Or?
The run-up to that, we started a veil of the conditions that apply to all the prisoners. We were held under, still held under a Home Office rules, which meant we didn't get the entitlement treatment that other prisoners had to pre-release schemes, etc. Then suddenly that was conceded to us. And I must have got out like about 100 days or something that was spread out before. So that's kind of a preparation for it. It wasn't sudden, suddenly you're out. I was in, I think it was 12 years and 4 months, and suddenly I'm outside of prison. It's a huge moment, you know. But on the 14th anniversary of my capture, I was released, you know, I was released. So it took place in December 2000.
And Pat, you struck up this extraordinary relationship with Joe Barry, whose father was killed in the Brighton bomb. Do you want to speak a bit about that and how that came about?
Well, I met Joe Barry that first time in November 2000. I thought it was going to be a one-off meeting. I was there, in a sense, wearing a political hat. I would try to explain to Joe, this woman, why we targeted Brighton, to put that operation in a context and hopefully do it with some sensitivity. And that first, that conversation became a conversation, lasted 3 hours. And it was a very incredible, intense experience for both of us, I'm sure. And it was an exchange. I was, again, explaining our motivations and the context of the day. She was telling me things about her own experiences of her father and of the impact of the bomb on her and her family. And she's clearly a very sound, intelligent woman who knew quite a bit about Ireland. In fact, had visited Belfast quite soon, within a couple of years, of her father's death, wanting to know. I was completely unaware of this. I only got to hear about this, as I said, a matter of months beforehand. But this is something she was committed to achieving long before that, right from, you know, the loss of her father. And, you know, like as I'm saying, you're gauging this woman, and at some stage, she recited a poem she'd written, and she'd written this sometime between 3 and 6 months before actually meeting me, before we were in this room sitting talking. And there was a phrase in the poem, "Now I stand before you who killed my father." She had actually prefigured the moment, and it was really affecting, you know. And it was like a completely different conversation after that. And as I said, I'm getting some impression of this woman. And she's a very fine woman. And then suddenly something just clicked. It's what I perceived in her, knew, must have, in some measure, coming from this man. It had come from him. She was clearly... the loss was apparent. And I killed this guy, you know. In other words, I killed a fine human being. And for me, it changed things. I couldn't articulate this feeling in the moment. But after that first meeting, I had all these thoughts, you know, and tried to put them down on paper too, you know, how to take this forward. I never for a moment thought there would be a second meeting, but I would have jumped at a second meeting. What I didn't appreciate was that Jo wanted the same. She wanted to meet me again. She also had this feeling that was more to be said, more to be explored. And the next meeting occurred 2 weeks later. And we've been meeting quite regularly since then.
Pat, it's been an extraordinary journey. And me and you have become good friends over this last number of years. And it's always good to have you here. I want to thank you, okay? I want to thank Michelle. And you're welcome back anytime. It'd be great to see you again.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks, Michelle.
Thanks a million.
This week we take a look at Bloody Sunday and the reverberations that followed for many years after. How has the city of Derry moved on from then, or can it ever fully? Thank you.
ocean of dua. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll adopt a thematic approach towards supplication, and we'll have a look at supplication from the point of view of different verses of the Holy Quran, and we'll also have a look at some parts of the transmitted supplications as well as the whispered prayers. So stay with us. Brothers and sisters, in the previous episodes, as you were previously with us, we were having a look at the first and foremost, the most important educational objective of supplications. We said that, of course, supplications are full of advantages. We even counted up to 8 or 7 different advantages and effects for supplications. And, of course, after mentioning all those advantages, we noticed the fact that there are some obstacles, some hindrances that the supplicant needs to be aware of. We, of course, said that even if our supplication superficially is not responded to, the mere engagement, the very fact that the supplicant has engaged in supplication is to a level, to some degree, a kind of response that we, all the human beings, need to be thankful for. But the fact is that there are some hindrances, some impediments that the supplicant needs to be aware of. Beyond that, there are some educational objectives for supplications that we were mentioning. We said that the most objective seen throughout the different parts of the supplications is that the Almighty Allah is referred to as the absolute cause by any kind of word and deed possible. For example, we read in the 36th supplication of Sahifa, وَأَنْزِلْ عَلَيْنَا نَفْغَ هَذِهِ السَّحَابِ وَبَرَكَتَهَا وَصْرِفْ عَنَّا أَذَاهَا وَمَضَرَّتَهَا. O Allah, please bring down on us the benefits and blessings of these clouds. Turn their harms away from us. Allahumma adhib mahalla biladina bisuqiyak. O Allah, take away the barrenness of our country by your rains. Take away the distress of our hearts by your blessing. Wa akhrij wahra sudurina birizqik. فَإِنَّ الْغَنِيَّ مَنْ أَغْنَيْتَ وَإِنَّ السَّالِمَ مَنْ وَقَيْتَ. The rich is the one whom you have made rich, and the safe is the one he whom you have protected. It is also said, اللَّهُمَّ إِنَّ هَاتَيْنِ آيَتَانِ مِنْ آيَاتِكَ. O Allah, cloud and lightning, these are two signs of yours. وَهَذَيْنِ عَوْنَانِ مِنْ أَعْوَانِكَ. You, these are your assistants. يَتَبَدَّرَانِ طَاعَتَكَ بِرَحْمَةٍ نَافِعَةٍ. These are the ones obeying you with profitable mercy or harmful wrath. أَوْ نِقْمَةٍ ضَرَّةٍ فَلَا تُمْطِرْنَا بِهَا مَطْرَ السَّوءِ. Please do not make them pour over us the rain of wrath. وَلَا تُلْبِسْنَا بِهِمَا لِبَاسَ الْبَلَاءِ. Please make them cover us with not the dress of distress.
I Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo kashti ab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju tishnagi avar bedas. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Ta beju shad abaz. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the merciful God will come towards you.
It's not a dream, this is so true. And we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua. Elsewhere, we read in the supplications that the Almighty Allah is praised. And praise belongs to the Almighty Allah, who is the creator of such and such. And by counting the different instances of the creations of the Almighty Allah, the supplicant will be more cognizant, will be more aware of the different blessings of the Almighty Allah. And of course, he will understand how powerful the Almighty Allah is. And beyond and above all that, he will realize that there is only one absolute cause in this universe. Alhamdulillah, الَّذِي خَلَقَ اللَّيْلَ وَالنَّهَارَ بِقُوَّتِهِ. This is the 6th supplication of Sahifatu Sajjadiyya. Praise be to Allah, who has created the night and the day with His power. وَمَيَّزَ بَيْنَهُمَا بِقُدْرَتِهِ. He is the one who distinguished between them with His might. وَجَعَلَ لِكُلِّ وَاحِدٍ مِّنْهُمَا حَدًّا مَّحْدُودًا. He is the one who has made for each of them a certain limit. وَخَلَقَ لَهُمُ اللَّيْلِ لِيَسْكُنُوا فِيهِ مِنْ حَرَكَاتِ التَّعَبِ. He is the one who has created for them the night to rest from hardships of the day. So, it is really noticeable that in these expressions, every move and even every immovability is directly related to God. And the whole causality is ascribed to more aware Allah. Not just more, but most aware Allah. وَخَلَقَ لَهُمُ النَّهَارَ مُبَصِرًا. He has created the day and made it bright for them. لِيَبْتَغُوا فِيهِ مِنْ فَضْلِهِ. To benefit from their Lord's favors. وَلِيَتَسَبَّبُوا إِلَىٰ رِزْقِهِ وَيَسْرَحُوا فِي أَرْضِهِ. To gain livelihood, to rove in his earth, طَلَبًا لِمَا فِيهِ نَيْلُ الْعَاجِلِ. To get the necessary needs of their worldly life. وَدَرْكُ الْآجِلِ فِي أُخْرَهُمْ. To ensure the later necessities of their afterlife. So it is truly noticeable that the infallible imams have considered themselves as the manifestations of God's attributes. In some traditions, they consider themselves as the very content of God's attributes. However, the structure of the truth behind God's attributes is beyond our thinking and our imagination. What we understand, however, is that in all these instances of the transmitted supplications of the Ahlul Bayt, the power of the absolute cause is directly at rest. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
At least 200 Palestinians are killed in an Israeli air raid on Jabalia refugee camp as the regime continues atrocities in the Gaza Strip for a 25th day. Yemeni armed forces say that they have fired drones and ballistic missiles at Israel in several operations, warning of more attacks if the onslaught on Gaza continues. And Iran once again warns the U.S. and Israel against further continuing